Hello everyone, this is Dark Journalist with a very special interview with Oxford scholar and Giza Death Star book series author, Dr. Joseph Farrell. Today, Dr. Farrell will go deep on the covert machinery that allows a whole category of advanced exotic UFO technology to remain behind a wall of secrecy, and how 75 years of CIA obfuscation and political lies have kept the game going right up until today. Have we hit a turning point? Please join us now. Let's track this UFO file through here. We got a big moment in 1947 with the UFO file.
Yes.
Through Kenneth Arnold.
Right.
This brings us also to the JFK assassination, oddly enough. Arnold will have his incredible sightings at Mount Rainier. And those craft are very interesting. You've pointed out before, they owe a great resemblance to the work of the Horton brothers. And they aren't actually saucers. They look more like boomerangs or crests.
Yeah, big flying wing.
Exactly. And his sighting is legitimate on so many levels because he is actually, the reason he's out there is he's trying to find a transport of Marines in a plane that disappeared a month earlier. And there's actually a reward for it.
Right.
So he has really good reason to be there. When he comes down and he gives this explanation, the whole craze takes off and there's an incredible wave of sighting.
Right.
One of the things that happens is he gets hired as a private investigator to go down and talk to some people at Maury Island in Washington who have seen a craft that gives off weird slag. These crafts that kind of donut shaped and they're giving off weird slag. They just ruin a boat and they kill a dog and a boy's arm gets burned.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of that story is someone named Fred Crisman.
Yep.
And so Fred Crisman is somebody who, you know, kind of jerks around with Arnold through that whole story, takes off to Alaska, and Arnold is left with a very bizarre situation, which he recounts in the only book that he wrote about the whole thing. Later, this very same Crisman is going to be put up as part of this trial assassination of the JFK assassination by Jim Garrison. And Garrison thinks, as he submits to his book publisher, this guy is the one who was involved directly with the shooting. He's a Boeing assassin.
Right.
So that's where he had arrived at. Yep. Crisman then connected to this very first UFO case pre Kenneth Arnold, actually pre his sighting. And in that whole before Roswell and everything else, what are we looking at with Crisman and his connection there to the UFO file and then the assassination?
Well, you're forgetting another important step in the Crisman story. And that is, who is taking the report? For Kenneth Arnold and for Maury Island? Who's covering all of that in 1947? Guy Bannister.
Guy Bannister, exactly.
He's the one filling out the reports on all of these incidents for the FBI.
Right.
Subject matter X.
Yes.
Because he's the special agent in charge. I think he was based in Boise at the time. So in other words, he's the one ultimately, if you're following all of these reports and the flow of information, when the reporters interview Kenneth Arnold, they in turn, all of that is getting back to Guy Bannister. He's filling out the reports for all of this. And so where does Bannister end up? Why? He ends up in New Orleans. And by the way, let's not forget, what's his name? Kerry, one of Crisman's cohorts, pardon me, ends up in New Orleans as well. And if I'm not mistaken, my memory tells me that at some point, Crisman himself ended up in New Orleans during this, you know, this same whole time period. So we've got this little nest of people that are, you know, Guy Bannister being right at the top of the heap, that are all connected to the issue of UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the big problem with Guy Bannister. When he is summoned to appear before the House Assassinations Committee, kind of like DeMorenschild, he suffers a convenient heart attack.
Right.
And all of his files go missing.
Exactly.
Now, here's a guy that had files out the wazoo. And Bannister strikes me as the kind of character, especially if he's dealing with subject matter X up there in Idaho and Maury Island and Kenneth Arnold and God knows what else he's dealing with related up there. He's the kind of guy that's going to make duplicates.
Yeah.
He's just that kind of guy. Absolutely. He's going to make duplicates of everything that he ever sent to Hoover. And I think probably it's just because Bannister is that kind of paranoid guy. Plus, he probably knows what he's dealing with Hoover.
Right.
You know, so Bannister gets summoned to the House on America, or the House Assassinations Committee. They're all a blur.
Warren Commission.
Well, basically.
Yeah.
And he suffers this heart attack, and his files go conveniently missing.
Right. What's interesting, they got rid of him really quick because he's involved in the assassination, happens in 63, and 64, boom.
Boom.
No, heart attack. And this is really interesting, too, because
Bannister. Yeah, you're right. It wasn't the House Committee. It was the Warren. Yeah, thank you.
Yes, that's where he was going.
Yeah.
But the pattern is exactly the same.
Yeah.
Bannister, very famously, has an employee in the summer before the assassination. The employee is Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yep.
Who was supposed to be a left-wing commie who just came back from Russia, and he's working for a right-wing, arc-right-wing FBI chief who's a private eye agency infiltrating student groups.
Yeah.
So instantly, that story...
Fresh back from the Soviet Union, too. Right.
So Oswald, as you know, a crazy Soviet-loving leftist, it doesn't make any sense him working for Bannister. So that story is just out the window.
Yes.
Whenever we get around Oswald, you've pointed this out, and it's absolutely undeniable. Whenever you get around Oswald, there's aerospace and UFO connections.
Yes.
Around him as the assassin and before he's the alleged assassin. And what is that about? There again, Bannister is another one, again, which shows that connection.
It's, if you want to know what it's about, radar.
Yeah, radar.
Because where is he stationed? Atsugi Air Force Base in Japan.
Yes, with a security clearance.
With a security clearance running radar, tracking U-2 flights. Voila.
If he had been a genuine defector to the Soviet Union and was getting like Pravda and all this stuff, they'd never let him anywhere near.
Never.
You too.
Never. Never. Not on your wildest dreams. And then you have to remember, when he defects to the Soviet Union, it is a little bit prior to the shoot down of Francis Gary Powers.
Right.
And if you really examine that whole story, Nikita Khrushchev played that whole thing brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they show all the wreckage on Soviet TV. People really have to understand what Nikita Khrushchev was doing. They show all of the wreckage of Powers U-2. On Soviet TV, and Khrushchev states that this was shot down by one of our missiles.
Wow.
Now, why does he do that? Because he's showing wreckage that clearly has no damage from a missile strike.
Oh, interesting.
He's doing this very deliberately. This is his little way of sending a message to the United States that he and the top bureaucrats at the Kremlin know that this thing was brought down by an inside job, which is what Francis Gary Powers himself always maintained.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I point out all of this in the LBJ Conspiracy to Kill Kennedy book. Mm-hmm. So Oswald, if he's passing along radar information to the Soviets and so on and so forth, I suspect as a result of the way the U-2 flight downing happened, I suspect that Oswald was passing along more intelligence than just that. He was passing on that they are going to crash a U-2 in your country, and so on and so forth. Ah. Otherwise, there's really nothing of any value that Oswald is giving the Soviets. But why then does he end up with a really cushy apartment in Minsk in Belarus at a really cushy job and able to marry a Soviet GRU colonel's daughter?
In a whirlwind romance.
You know, is Soviet military intelligence that sloppy? Answer, no. there's all sorts of aspects to this that just, when you look at the details, makes no sense.
Absolutely.
Unless Oswald is an operative and this whole thing is part of some vast, elaborate operation. Yeah, then it starts to make sense.
Wow, absolutely fascinating. And Powers, you've pointed this out before, he dies under unusual circumstances in a plane crash.
Helicopter crash. He was a helicopter newsman or traffic reporter in the Los Angeles area. And his helicopter apparently crashed when he was, you know, doing one of his on-air remote broadcasts on the air. So, in other words, we've got a U-2 pilot that doesn't know how to fly a helicopter.
it's kind of remarkable. This is someone they didn't want out there.
No.
No, they didn't want the tell-all book coming out.
No. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely fascinating. Oswald is there in Russia and then decides, you know what? I really need to go back to the United States.
Marina.
Yeah, with Marina. And the State Department says, okay, and you know what? Here's $1,500 to get back, too.
Yeah.
So he's being moved back into position. And mm-hmm. when he comes back, he will spend the summer in New Orleans of 1963 before the assassination, and he'll work at Riley Coffee Company.
Uh-huh.
And Riley is interesting. for a lot of reasons, but one of the interesting things that he says when he's leaving is, I'm going to join NASA.
Yep.
And then Garrison, 4 years later, investigating the case,
yep.
goes to track down those fellow employees at Riley to get some kind of read on what Oswald was doing and all the rest. And he finds out all of them have gone to join NASA.
Yep.
What's that all about?
Well, obviously, Riley Coffee Company is a cutout.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's a front, and what's really interesting about it is, since when does NASA use cutouts?
Right.
You know, what possible value could a coffee company employee have to NASA?
Right. It doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So in other words, this is a cutout, but NASA doesn't normally recruit people from cutouts. Who does?
The CIA. Yeah.
Sure. Or the NRO or the NSA. But, you know, it's a three-letter agency.
Yes.
That's recruiting for NASA in a coffee company. So the cutout tells me, all right, we've got a cutout in New Orleans, of all places, which is not well known for its aerospace industry. Let's put it that way.
Right.
So what is a coffee company that's functioning as a cutout doing recruiting for NASA?
Exactly.
You know, and I have no idea, Daniel, other than this is another one of these bizarre links in this whole story, that if we knew all the facts to, it would make sense. But unfortunately, we don't. All we can say is it's a cutout. We've got all these NASA people there. And is the company a cutout for NASA security? Well, we do have, you know, the Torbett document and its allegations about the Defense Industrial Security Command and Wernher von Braun and
DISC
and so on and so forth. But maybe it's a cutout and recruiting op for that. I don't know.
Interesting. The Torbett document, which is like a 1970 WikiLeaks after the Garrison assassination. The Garrison trial of the JFK assassination. It goes into great detail about DISC, which no one has ever heard of prior to that. But what's interesting about it is, one, it makes sense.
Yes.
And two, the people that are listed as agents, Guy Bannister, Lee Harvey Oswald, David Ferry, we find them all working in that,
milieu.
Yeah. And we all find them in the heart of the Garrison trial. So Garrison is right there. He's face to face with this thing, but he doesn't know what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the Torbett document, people have to remember, the Torbett document is essentially a compilation that was done by a South Texas lawyer based in and around Fire McAllen. So, in other words, way down there in the southern tip of Texas, who was allegedly part of Lyndon Johnson's machine.
Right.
And he did this whole document as kind of a compilation of all the stuff that had been uncovered in the Garrison investigation. Mm-hmm. So in other words, the Garrison files, which incidentally, you know, a lot of them are still under wraps.
The whole CIA file on Garrison is gone.
It's under wraps. Yeah. The Torbett document is the only thing that we have that can peer into some aspects of the Garrison investigation that does not come out during Clay Shaw's trial.
Right.
So, you know, it's a key piece of documentary evidence. But it has to be handled with some care. Mm-hmm. But the thing about the Torbett document is there are details in it you learn nowhere else.
Yes. Oh, it's completely original.
It's totally original. And some of the details are so, let's be honest, laughably bizarre.
Yes.
That no one in their right mind would come up with them.
Yes.
Unless they were true. You know, it's of that nature. For example, the Umbrella Man.
Right.
Is identified in the Torbett document as being Ferenc Nagy. Hungary, who was the fascist premier of Hungary in Admiral Horthy's regency during World War II. So,
maybe he is in Dallas. In fact,
he is in Dallas on the day of the assassination. And some people say that, you know, if you look at Umbrella Man pumping his, what is a fascist premier of Hungary doing in Dealey Plaza on a sunny day with an umbrella?
You're right.
Clearly giving the go-ahead signal, you know, proceed. You know. These are the kinds of things that you find in the Torbett document.
Amazing.
And the interesting thing about the document, Daniel, I to this day defy anybody to dispute. Had it not been for the Torbett document, we would never have known, other than through the Clay Shaw trial. And it's a detail that doesn't really get hammered in the Clay Shaw trial. It certainly does in the Torbett document. We would never have known about Permandex or Central Mondial Comercial, or in other words, the World Trade Center operation.
Yeah.
None of that would ever have made the light of day.
Wow. And Permandex, which you explored very well in your book, but what we know about it is that it was set up as a CIA front, as an assassination.
Yeah.
Pulse. And it was booted out of Italy for those activities.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
And Permandex so
and Central, yeah. And guess who has a huge share of the stock in the company in Montreal?
Who?
Bronfman.
Oh, that's right. Bronfman and
who's yeah. connected to Bronfman? Why? The original swamp creature.
Cone.
Roy Cone. He's one of their attorneys. And who's he connected with?
Trump. Our friend Trump. Mm-hmm. This is quite fascinating because the Cone piece shows up in the Torbit document as close around that airspace,
yes.
advanced aerospace piece.
Yes.
That's strange, too, considering...
It's strange, Daniel, considering the fact that when the Torbit document was published in 1973, the McCarthy-Monmouth hearing transcripts were not.
Right.
They were not published until 2003. So anyone making the assertion that Roy Cone had something to do with advanced aerospace technology in 1973 is doing this either on a lark or they have some pretty secure inside information, and it's the latter, because as I pointed out in the McCarthy book, when the Monmouth transcripts are finally released, it's very clear that Senator McCarthy and Roy Cone both knew something about UFOs and so on and so forth, yeah. simply by the way they're asking questions from the witnesses that they're summoning.
Absolutely. And you've got in your books on this, which really dived in deep, mm-hmm. You've got the UFO mention, Project Blue Book, and Roswell
in the Monmouth transcripts.
And Cone is asking those questions.
And Cone and McCarthy are both asking these questions. And let's remember what Monmouth at that time was doing. It was doing top secret radar research.
Right.
So, again, we're back to radar.
Interesting points. There's a quality, I would say, to Cone's interrogation of those military people, which uh-huh. is like, you better share this with us or else.
Yeah.
And it's very aggressive.
You can read those transcripts, and I think what you're getting there is Cone is the bad cop. He's the aggressive questioner. McCarthy, if you read McCarthy's questions, they're the subtle questions.
Mm.
McCarthy's the one tossing out dates. Oh, by the way, what were you doing down in New Mexico on such and such a date? And he's doing this at points when you read the transcripts where it would have been rather obvious if you were the witness that you were under extreme stress, and then bang, you get these little detailed, these little detailed questions from McCarthy. Oh, what about that? You know. So this was very true of their public performances. But when you watch the transcripts, the way Cone and McCarthy and some of the other people on the committee play off of each other mm-hmm. in their questioning of these witnesses, it's really quite brilliant. You're dealing with some very astute lawyers, you know, certainly Cone was and certainly McCarthy was. You're dealing with some very astute lawyers that are drawing out this information, and they're doing it very subtly.
Wow.
You know, they're doing it very, very subtly.
Mm-hmm.
They managed to get the Monmouth people to admit with, you know, that they were indeed in New Mexico doing radar work during the Roswell incident.
Amazing.
You know, that's huge when you get right down to it. And that this is coming from Roy Cone and Joseph McCarthy.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it really is.
That's a really interesting point about the date of the Torbit document referencing yes. these things, and then those transcripts don't come out. So whoever is writing...
They don't come out for 30 years after the Torbit document.
So the Torbit document has the inside access.
Right.
It's right. a reflection of that. And let's right. face it, DISC, when you look into it, it makes sense.
Yeah.
For sure, as a whole NASA security division, and it's headed up by Von Braun. Which also makes sense.
Now, let's look at that aspect of the story, the DISC story, just very briefly. you'll recall in my other books, SS Brotherhood of the Bell and so on and so forth, Covert Wars, Breakaway Civilizations, and all that, I've pointed out numerous times the same thing that Linda Hunt pointed out in her book about these paperclip Nazis, and that was that after their arrival in this country and their basing in El Paso, Texas, that they appeared to have recreated the entire command structure that they had inside of Nazi Germany. That's number one. Number two, they were driving around in Mercedes automobiles that were quite expensive and beyond the ability of their army salary to support. So in other words, they're getting money from somewhere. And number three, the biggie, is that they have dead drops that they use inside of Mexico.
Oh, wow.
So in other words,
outside of the reach of the United States.
Outside of the reach of the United States. So what happens is the American Army counterintelligence after the Roswell incident, this is key, after the Roswell incident reopens the security vetting procedures on most of those Nazis. And guess who's at the top of the list?
Who?
Kurt Davis.
Amazing.
They reopen his file because they learned that he had denounced a colleague of his in 1942 in Nazi Germany to the Gestapo. So they reopen his file. And who is Kurt Davis? Well, Kurt Davis is not a rocket scientist. He's a high voltage discharge and plasma physicist. It is Kurt Davis that is put in charge of the Apollo missions at Cape Canaveral during Project Apollo.
Incredible.
That's the head guy. Very close friend with Von Braun. You often see their pictures together. Davis is the guy with the mensura on his face.
Mm-hmm.
And then Davis, just before he retires from NASA, is put in charge of what?
The UFO file.
The UFO disc.
Unbelievable.
Then he retires from NASA and becomes a board member of OTROG in the Congo.
Right. And OTROG in the Congo is Area 51 in the Congo run by Germans.
By the German government. So in other words, the disc operation, it would not surprise me at all to see Von Braun in charge of a Defense Industrial Security Command, if they have reproduced their chain of command, if they're running dead drops, and if they are getting another source of income that's not their salary for the U.S. Army or the U.S. Air Force.
Incredible. The person that makes me think of is Walter Dornberger.
Ding, ding, ding.
General Dornberger.
General Dornberger.
And he's, in fact, von Braun's boss in Nazi Germany.
He's von Braun's boss, right.
We know one of the key things about Dornberger is that at the judgment at Nuremberg, he was to be tried for crimes against humanity and put to death. And it's von Braun's intercession that gets him out of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
He takes over. He comes over and he becomes a VP at Bell Helicopter.
Bell Helicopter, that's correct.
The connection there with Dornberger, again, we have another Nazi connection with the JFK assassination because his protege is Michael Payne.
Yep.
And Michael Payne and Ruth Payne host
the Oswalds,
who have just come back from their tour of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So when you look at that and you see the connection there of Dornberger, and Dornberger, again, involved deeply with the X-15, very secret aerospace projects. He is, in fact, that X technology. He's the face of it. You're looking at the secret technology piece directly with Oswald, Payne, and Dornberger.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. If you look at Dornberger, and what he did inside of Nazi Germany. Dornberger is a curious figure in that he's kind of a a bureaucrat manager who is running, his actual department that he works for is the Heereswaffenamt, which would be the Army Ordnance Bureau, would be a way to translate that. And the particular part of the Ordnance Bureau that he's working for the artillery and bombardment wing. So in other words, Dornberger's a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And as a manager of that type of project, he's also a security man.
Interesting.
So he's a good choice for von Braun and the other Nazis to bring over. And let's not forget what I said about the South American wing of this. You have three very interesting people in Nazi Germany that quote-unquote die at the end of the war, often two or three times, and each time is a bit different than the other. You've got Martin Bormann.
Yes.
You've got Heinrich Miller, and you've got Hans Kammler.
Right.
And I call them the unholy trinity. Why are those three important? Well, Bormann is the financial genius. He's the guy that sets up this post-war Nazi financial outfit. Heinrich Miller, Gestapo Miller was his nickname, was the guy that covered up Hitler's affair with his niece and then her subsequent and very suspicious suicide.
All right.
And did so at the behest of Martin Bormann. Gestapo Miller ends up putting that triple ring of security around all of Bohemia.
Oh, right, yeah.
In Czechoslovakia as part of Kammler's operation. Uh-huh. And Hans Kammler is the guy that's heading up all of Nazi Germany's secret research projects.
Including
the Bell. And by the way, he's also the guy in charge of all the slave labor.
Oh, right.
So if you want three people to set up a post-war Nazi international, well, look what you've got. You've got finance and management. You've got security, intelligence, and counterintelligence. And then you've got the actual management of the projects themselves, including the recruitment and the labor.
Amazing.
There you go.
If you were to follow the trajectory of those three, do they all land in Argentina?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. Wow. Bormann, I think you'd have to read Ladislaus Farrago's book about the survival of Bormann in Latin America. And I defy anybody to read that book and come away from it with any other conclusion than that he got out of there. And, you know, headed up this, whatever it is, Heinrich Miller.
Nazi peace.
Yeah. Heinrich Miller, when they dug him up, they found three different people by the DNA in his grave, and he was none of them.
Amazing.
And, you know, Hans Kammler, what can we say? This guy dies four different times under different circumstances in each account. You know, and there's been the recent book, I forget who it was, that the authors of this book that document American intelligence connections that he had in this country after the war. And
the hidden Nazi. Yeah.
The hidden Nazi. And certainly by the sources that I was able to track in Argentina, he certainly had connections there and probably visited the country there as well. So you've got an enormous post-war network of these people. And if John Kennedy had learned, as I suspect that he did, of the extent to which the American military and industrial complex communities violated President Truman's orders not to bring any of these people over here, if he learned about that, then Kennedy has a motivation for smashing the CIA into 1,000 pieces. And they, in turn, have a motivation to get rid of him.
Incredible. This is the face-off
right underneath
the surface battle between the presidents right, and the CIA.
Right.
Absolutely fascinating. And at the heart of it is the exotic technology.
Technology. Right.
Because, after all, that's why we're getting these guys over in paperclip.
Well, if we want to go to the moon, and folks, let me go on record here. I am not an Apollo hoaxer. I think we went to the moon.
Right.
Are there questionable aspects of the narrative of how we got there, and more importantly, how we got off of it? Absolutely. No two questions about it.
Well, it's so mysterious. Even believing that they went, of course, you know, and it seems obvious that they went, and yet there's so many odd things about it, like the filming of the false version of it.
Well, not only that, but the real problem is, how did we get off?
Yes.
And, you know, Von Braun lost his job at NASA. You know, we land on the moon and, you know, everybody in the world is going, gaga, congratulations, USA, you did it, blah, blah, blah. And we're feeling, you know, we're feeling pretty good about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then within 3 weeks, and, you know, Wernher von Braun was the toast of, you know, every party in D.C. And then within mm-hmm. 3 weeks, he's resigned from NASA, and he takes this weird job at Fairchild Industries, and then he just kind of fades from view. Well, he gave an interview in what I think ended his career at NASA. He gave that very strange little interview to Time magazine. It appeared in one of their little boxes at the bottom of the page. I remember it very well because I've read it. And he's talking about, you know, oh, at 43,950 miles or some figure around 43,000 miles, the spacecraft hit the equigravisphere, the neutral point of gravity between the Earth and the moon. And then from that point, it's the moon's gravity that's carrying this thing towards the moon. And it was after that little slip that he's out of there. Why? Because run the numbers. 1/6 the gravity is going to be a place much closer to the surface of the moon than 43,000 miles.
Interesting.
He let out the fact that I think the Soviet and American space agencies had begun to suspect, because they kept sending probes to the moon and they kept, you know, zinging by the moon or crashing into the moon, but they couldn't get it right. Well, if you're dealing with the wrong figures for its gravity, then that's going to be how your probes are going to behave. They're not going to behave the way they're supposed to.
Wow.
So, I think he let it out.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And it also lets out the idea that we don't know as much about the moon as we think we do in the public.
And it also lets out the idea why you'd put someone like Kurt Davis in charge of the Apollo missions.
Right. Yes.
Because you're using a hidden technology to get us there and to get us off of there.
Right.
So I suspect, ever since I published SS Brotherhood of the Bell way back when, I suspect that a deal was made between the NASA people and their Nazis to get access to some of that technology that could get us there and off.
Mm-hmm.
And in return, they would have access to whatever we found,
wow.
Which I suspect was considerable. And I suspect that it's that bargain that is really behind why NASA can't tell the truth of what it's finding out there.
Fascinating. You think they found ruins when they went to the moon?
Well, I think I'm in the Hoagland camp. I think they not only found ruins there, I think they found them on Mars. And I think they made a dirty deal with, you know, the Nazi devil mm-hmm. to share whatever real intelligence we gathered. And that's the reason that NASA can't tell any truth.
Wow.
There's an agreement in play.
It's amazing because, you know, they're talking about Artemis, of course, setting it up. They sent this capsule up there. They had a bunch of delays, like
yep.
8 delays.
Well, we've run out of German rocket scientists.
Right.
Well, if need to find some new ones. Hey,
Lord,
Germany.
Lord of mercy.
Yeah, Lord have mercy.
When you look at that and you see that from 1972 – mm-hmm. to 2022, mm-hmm. we haven't sent anybody back to the moon.
Right.
That's 50 years of complete abandoning of the manned space missions. What's the heart of that? That's the development of the secret space program.
Well, I think it's the development of the secret space program, but you'll notice something. Everybody talks about America hasn't been back. Well, the Russians certainly could have gone.
Yes. Right.
They're not interested.
Right.
The Chinese have gone. They've sent probes to the far side of the moon. They let out a couple pictures, which were interesting.
Yeah. But
they ain't talking. A few years ago, you remember, the Japanese sent this school bus-sized satellite to the moon and were snapping pictures like nobody's business, and they let out one.
Right.
One. The Indians have been back and orbited the moon with a polar orbiter, and they let out, I think it was two or three. So, in other words, everybody's going back there, but nobody's talking.
Interesting. And the gap of time of 50 years, it's the complete inexplicable gap in history.
Right.
It's like it's like the 18-minute gap on the Watergate tapes. It's just a race, 50 years of non-development. You have these, we have a shuttlecraft, and they have problems with those. Joseph, when you look at that, that is absolutely fascinating because there's no good explanation for it. There's no good explanation for the original moon story.
Well, remember, the very first studies of the moon were based in the late 1950s, and they were optical telescopic studies of the moon that were top secret.
Mm.
In other words, they were snapping pictures like crazy long before any probes were sent there. And all of those things are top secret.
Amazing.
So my conclusion is, you can go online and take pictures, find pictures of the moon, and you start looking at it carefully and closely, and you'll start finding all sorts of junk.
Interesting.
Yeah, right.
Well, we know that they've made a serious effort to airbrush those original books and photos and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And there is this person who came forward, and he had been at NASA, and he was being shown that there were all these structures on the far side of the moon, and he realized he got scared. He was like, I don't have the security clearance to be looking at this. And he knew he was, that was a problem.
The story of Richard Hoagland going through, the catalogs of the Apollo missions, and they have all of these, plates of photographs that you can order. And there's lots of these blank plates that are nothing but black, and they'll be right in the middle of a bunch. So Hoagland says, oh, I want to order that one. So he orders, he orders a picture from a plate that in the catalog is nothing but black.
Wow.
And he gets this picture and is full of stuff,
Wow.
So again, I would not be a bit surprised. I think there's been an embargo put in place, and that this embargo has something to do with the Nazis, number one. But here's, here it comes, folks. I'm crawling out to the end of the twig, I might as well crawl off of it. In 2015, at the Bastrop Space Program conference, I talked about the Slavonic text of the Book of Enoch.
Right.
And how in that text, the orbit of the moon is used to describe a kind of quarantine zone around the Earth.
Interesting.
It's kind of like the Treaty of Versailles demilitarized zone that begins at the Rhine River in Germany. No military forces on the west bank of the Rhine.
Excellent point.
Okay. So in other words, it's a quarantine zone that you're setting up around the planet, and it's very old, obviously. But that idea implies that there is some sort of treaty in place that, you know, is millennia, if not eons old for whatever reason. And, you know, the books I've written, I think it's because we fought a war and blew up a planet, you know. Yes. So bad little monkeys, you stay on that planet.
Right, exactly.
Leave the rest of us alone. You know?
Well, you've made a fantastic case for it. I found corroboration in the Edgar Cayce readings.
For sure. Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, he talks about wars and quarantine zones. You know, it's not as if this is a big secret.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the other possibility here is that, you know, we're sending out all these space probes to, you know, the planets and so on and so forth. We always make a point to put on the probes a little plaque. We're coming in peace for all mankind. Right. Like, who are we worried about out there?
who's planning to read it? Yeah.
Who's planning to read that? So, you know, the other possibility here is that there is an embargo over all of these things.
Right.
Because some other group of people is mm-hmm. involved. And quite frankly, they have liens, of, you know, to use our financial language, they have liens on all of that stuff.
Exactly.
So who knows? You know, I entertain all possibilities.
That's a great explanation for a 50-year gap. If you go up there and you have problems,
right?
Then you're not going to send anything back up there, and you'll make up some excuse like, "Oh, it's not in the budget," even though you've already laid the budget out for it.
Yeah, that's a little problem. And, you know, there are those who say that Apollo 13, you know, the one that had all the things happening to it. There are people that believe that there was some sort of UFO event that got all of that started. Now, I've never seen any solid evidence for it, but there are people that make that claim that, you know, this was the warning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, quit coming up here and taking our rocks back down there.
Joseph, who is flying all these UFOs?
I don't know. And I defy anybody that says they do. that said, I do think it's clear that with a lot of them, you're dealing with a very advanced but very human terrestrial technology. I think that's clear.
Yes.
I think in some cases, you're dealing with definite technologies that are pushing the boundaries of what we're capable of. And I'm thinking particularly in terms of some of those space shuttle footages that show these weird disc-like things with a little spiraling thing that kind of pop into view or pop out of view. And there's two ways to explain those things. You're dealing either with a stealth technology that's being switched on and off, and it's not all that inhuman, or you're dealing with things making dimensional hops, because the signature is going to be exactly the same.
Oh, interesting.
But if it's the latter, then, you know, as far as I know, humans don't have that capability. Then you've got another fact that I think enters the thinking of people like Alfred Leyding, that I talked about in my book, Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations. Well, Leyding was this German-American engineer that very early on suspected that a lot of this UFO tech was Nazi in nature. But he subsequently concluded that not all of it could be, because there was simply too many UFO incidents. And his reasoning was basically, this technology that the Nazis came up with is so complex and so complicated, it's very difficult to engineer and to have it account for all of the vast numbers of all these sightings. So there's another player involved here.
Wow.
So, you know, I'm kind of in that camp.
Yeah.
That, you know, you're dealing with somebody that is possibly not human in the sense of not of the species Homo sapiens sapiens.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think ultimately you're dealing with some sort of genetic, if we're talking about the existence of extraterrestrials, then I think you're dealing at some point with people that are genetic cousins. Mm-hmm.
There is a relation.
There's some sort of relation between these hairless monkeys on this planet and whatever hairless monkeys are out there. Because there's too many strange things about human history. Mm-hmm. You know, there's too many strange texts that indicate that we've got some connection with living beings out there that look like us and walk like us and, you know, all the other stuff. There are genetic anomalies in the human genome that no one can really adequately explain, particularly Charles Darwin. Thank you very much.
Oh, wow.
You know, that whole evolutionary circus that goes on and on.
Like, all right. Talk about a religion. My God.
Yeah. Talk about a religion. There you go, folks. But anyway. You know, they're still waiting for the missing link, like the evangelicals are waiting for the rapture. But it's
fascinating. You know, this is very off the track, but I was reading a story about this King Tut jewelry that they found when they discovered him, and the meteorite.
Yeah,
that was on his breastplate, mm-hmm. and it was only found in this one Libyan desert. It was mm-hmm. extreme edge, and it was a piece of a meteorite, but somehow they knew to get it and put it into his breastplate. There's something there. They understand something in those cultures about our relationship that we lost.
Yes.
In relation to the space relation, you know, and it's kind of whether it has to do with what's out there or who is out there, they seem to have a track for it, the star.
Yes. System. Yeah, absolutely. It's really modern mankind that's, you know, and particularly in the materialistic West, that's lost this idea that we've got some sort of connection. I don't have any problem with it. You know, I don't see what the big deal is. We've got those stories in the book of Genesis. We've got those stories in the Vedic literature. You know, it's fairly universal in the world. So I don't see what the big deal is. The only thing those stories tend to make very clear is that not all those people are our space brothers.
Right.
and have our good intentions in heart, you know. This is where the narrative starts to go off the rails.
The Tower of Babel.
That was just all a big misunderstanding.
Joseph, to round it all out.
Sure.
President Kennedy grappling with the UFO issue and the forces around it in aerospace, in politics, in intelligence. His level of knowledge gives him the ability to say, I know what's going on with this.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets that knowledge through Forrestal and others.
Yes.
But when he comes in, the real face-off is, I know I'm on the same level with mm-hmm. you. Mm-hmm. And we are, you know, I know what you're up to, and I'm going to make moves, therefore, to balance out the situation so it's not your secret.
Right.
Is that a good way to look through the lens?
I think it's a good way to look at it for the following. In fact, I think it's one of the principal ways to look at it. Not the only way, but it's certainly a principal way of doing so for the following reason. I've said many times, Daniel, that American history from his murder in 1963 up to the election of Donald Trump in 2016 is one arc of American history.
Right.
And the reason why I say Trump is because if you look at Kennedy and the apparent knowledge that he had of this phenomenon. And let's remember, a lot of that knowledge probably came from Joe McCarthy.
Yes. There's the connection there. They're close.
The Kennedys and McCarthy are very close. So if there is a UFO interest that the Kennedys may have been exposed to privately, I'm suspecting it's coming from that quarter.
Mm-hmm.
by the same token, when President Trump takes office, you're dealing with another man that had access to those kinds of private sources of information that would have put him many levels ahead of the standard occupant of the Oval Office.
Right.
And would have put him in the same league as a John Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, those connections go to McCarthy through Roy Cohn.
Mm-hmm.
And they also go to a completely different area with his uncle
mm-hmm.
at MIT.
Yes.
So you've got two presidents there, one of whom was, you know, they did everything they could to get rid of him,
mm-hmm.
short of assassination.
Right.
And I really honestly think that, you know, if you look at some of the circumstances surrounding his family, I think there were assassination attempts on him.
Amazing.
You know, the helicopter business with Melania and so on
yes.
and so forth. I think there were assassination attempts, but they finally let that go because it would have been looked too suspicious to try and do that again. So I'm looking at Kennedy and Trump as two presidents who are intimately involved in the UFO question.
Right.
And we have to remember, in Trump's case, Hillary was supposed to be the UFO president.
Exactly.
And in Trump's case, we also had all of those strange interviews, supposedly, that took place between him and his son, you know, with his son asking him about this stuff and him saying, I can't talk about it.
About Roswell.
Maybe. About Roswell, yes. About Roswell. So I'm suspecting that these two presidents have at least the UFO file in common, and that's the reason why they went after them with such a vengeance.
Incredible. Yeah. Yeah. It adds up. It does. Yeah. And Trump has all the information from his uncle because his uncle was the protege of Vannevar Bush, who led the
Vannevar UFO Bush. War. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So that's the inside track.
Yeah. And we don't, you know, the other peculiar thing, we don't know exactly what Roy Cohn ever told Donald Trump, because Trump doesn't talk about Cohn.
He doesn't.
You know, it's like this is a taboo subject.
Exactly.
They were tight. And the other tightness about Trump is that he was also a very close friend with JFK Jr.
Exactly.
So, you know, there's yet another Kennedy connection here.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I look at this and I'm thinking that, you know, somebody in the government, probably Alan Dulles, made the deal with the fascist devil at the end of World War II and may have got a lot more than just fascists in the bargain.
Interesting. Yes. That's incredible to ponder.
Yeah, it is.
Kennedy then shows up and defies their plans dramatically. As a matter of fact, he's a force that they don't anticipate.
Right.
And he is...
He's Asimov's mule.
Yes.
Right. He's the mule from Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy. That's mm-hmm. exactly what he is.
Incredible. And he takes them on to the point of sending the memo 10 days before he's assassinated, saying, yep. I want those high-threat UFO files.
Yep.
But he does other things. He visits air bases. He goes to, you know, the AEC in Nevada. He's going to the heart of where they keep these things.
Yes.
And he's reasserting on some level executive control over
yes.
a runaway national security state. And that, in the final analysis, is why they go out to such a degree to take him out.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the other thing we need to remember about Kennedy is, who's the president briefing him as he's leaving office?
Eisenhower. Yes.
You know, so what did Eisenhower tell him in that half an hour or so that they were in private conversation?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the man that gave the military-industrial complex speech, you know, shortly before Kennedy takes office.
Incredible speech.
It's a jaw-dropper, you know. when you listen,
watch out for your own military.
Yeah, watch out for your own military, because they're out to get you, folks. No, you know, it's a jaw dropper, and you just know that something like that had to be on the agenda of what he was going to tell JFK, because, you know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, who's hot to trot to go into Cuba and start World War III? Well, Curtis LeMay, you know, right. no friend of John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
So LeMay, you know, came up with the Strategic Integrated Operational Plan, the PSYOP, that Eisenhower saw. Finally, you know, they let him see the plan of how they were going to respond to the Soviet Union. And basically it was launch everything and turn the entire communist world into a radioactive cinder for the next 50 to 75 years.
Nice.
And, you know, Eisenhower was appalled as any rationally thinking human being would
My
be.
God. Yeah.
You know, so you have to wonder exactly what Eisenhower told Kennedy. I suspect it was a lot of things, and that this also is entering into Kennedy's calculations when he's dealing with UFO files and bankers and so on and so forth.
Amazing. Joseph, how do you evaluate the final piece of evidence here, which is something that's buried in a movie that came out that Kennedy supported called 7 Days in May, which is about a COG commander taking over. And he's walking in there, and they, bright as day, you know, he actually allowed them to use the White House to shoot this thing. There's a map behind Burt Lancaster, who's playing this General Scott. And right there on the back of the map is Roswell.
Yes. Yeah.
What is, I mean, those, the filmmakers know Kennedy's giving them that.
Daniel, that film, 7 Days in May, actually, that and its remake. There was another remake of that with Sam Waterston and Forrest Whitaker,
right?
Playing the character that was played by Kirk Douglas in the original movie.
Yes,
both movies are well worth watching.
No question. They're so advanced for what they're trying to tell us.
Yeah, they are. But the original one with Douglas and Lancaster and Frederick March, John Houseman, even
right,
Professor Kingsfield. But
I mean, it's remarkable the way it's structured.
That movie is so full of revelations. I mean, there's just no two ways about it.
And it's Frankenheimer again at the helm.
Again,
who also does the Manchurian Candidate, which gets buried.
Yes. And again, but, another remake, you know.
Yes.
The original Manchurian Candidate, you know, they, with Angela Lansbury, again, that whole thing is remarkable. But the 7 Days in May, Daniel, there's no doubt in my mind that those little things where you see Burt Lancaster and the map with, you know, Roswell, and that these are very deliberate messages.
Yeah.
I think these are very deliberate messages. The Roswell part of it intrigues me because it was done in such a way as to avoid any suggestion that there was something extraterrestrial involved there.
Right.
The whole thing was hinging around this whole continuity of government operation.
Yes.
And the very interesting thing in terms of identities there is General Scott, James Mattoon Scott, the character played by Burt Lancaster, I strongly suspect is a kind of a composite character when you examine his role in the film and the things that he says and what he's involved in doing. That character strikes me as a composite of General Lyman Lemnitzer, mm-hmm. and General Curtis LeMay, who right. were two of Kennedy's biggest opponents. And of course, Kennedy was able to get rid of Lemnitzer and, you know, shipped him off to Europe and replaced him with Taylor. But yes. he was never able to get rid of LeMay. LeMay was just too powerful. But I strongly suspect the Burt Lancaster character that there's even more interesting things there to go through and comb through in that movie. And then, again, in the background, in other words, I'm suggesting the entire movie is a message and that you can identify all those characters in it. And the one that I'm still intrigued with is, who's Ava Gardner?
Right.
You know, she, lovely actress, you know, yeah. and she was a good singer, if you've ever heard her sing. But you know, who's Ava Gardner's character? It's a very strange character. And I don't get the impression it was done just for a love interest.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't have that feel to it. She's there for a reason. So who is she?
The whole movie feels coded like that.
The whole movie is coded, in my opinion. Yeah. The whole movie is coded.
Remarkable. The desert base.
The desert base. The, you know, why the emphasis on an admiral in charge of the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean? Why Ava Gardner?
Mm.
You know, who are these people? And, you know, while we're talking about movies with messages, you also mentioned Executive Action.
Yes.
You know, and what is it about Burt Lancaster?
There he is again.
Yeah, gets these very weird roles, you know.
He's the mastermind of the entire assassination in that.
Yes, exactly. He's
ex-protect incarnate.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And his character in Executive Action, again, you want to talk about a movie with messages, screenplay by Dalton Trumbo. Well, you know, investigate Dalton Trumbo and you discover he was one of the Hollywood writers that was fingered by the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Oh,
you know, many, yeah. Because he was a radical leftist.
Yes.
But, you know, screenplay by Dalton Trumbo, Grandpa Rockefeller, played by Will Gere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They do an excellent job of portraying Oswald in that too, about how they have to watch films to get him down, because the two Oswalds thing, this guy has to show up and act just like him.
Yeah. Yeah. The film, and as you say, it ends with that actuarial note when you see the pictures of all the dead witnesses and how many there are.
Wow.
You know, unreal.
And they enlisted an actuary to figure out the odds of all those witnesses dying from the Warren Commission in that short period of time. And the odds were 100,000 trillion to one.
Yeah. It's impossible. It's impossible.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And the reasons, you know, karate chop, mistaken for a deer. It's an amazing
suicide by shotgun blast.
Yeah. Oh, does that sound familiar? Joseph, whenever they had those committees, there was always this wave of strange deaths. Johnny Roselli, DeMorn Schultz. That's pretty obvious.
Trafficante,
yeah.
Yeah, all of them. The mob seemed to have its mob wars right at the time that Congress is investigating the assassination. Gee, what a coincidence.
And there's Cohn with Bronfman and related to aerospace.
Yeah.
So there is that loop.
Oh, there's so many connections that spin out from all of this. And it's just, you know, it's a measure of networking theory for one thing, but it's also a measure of just how corrupt a lot of these networks are. And that if you start to tangle with them, you'd better have your own ducks in a row and be willing to roll a few heads, because that's the only language these people understand. You know, Kennedy found out the hard way. Trump, I think the odd thing about Trump was that the Kennedy family let most of its mob ties go after the end of Prohibition. Trump, you know, I've always maintained that as a casino and real estate property developer, he's got to maintain those ties to that segment of the deep state. So you don't want to tangle with him.
Right.
You know, there's no doubt in my mind they tried a couple of assassination attempts, and there's no doubt in my mind that his own people warned him about him.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. Mm-hmm. That is actually fascinating when you think about the level of Trump. And one of those big pieces of the deep state that operates around him is the mafia piece.
Yep, absolutely.
It's undeniable.
It's absolutely undeniable. Trump Tower wouldn't have been built, folks, without Roy Cohn. It's just no two ways about it.
The final piece here is at the end of his administration, Trump does two interesting things. One, he fires the defense secretary. Huh? Who appointed a new COG commander, that
uh-huh.
And then he enacts Kennedy's NSAM 57.
Yes.
Which defangs the CIA and turns them into a support unit.
Yeah.
And it was activated for January 7th.
Basically, what you're saying is Trump activated continuity of government before he left office.
Yes.
I can see part of it, because what we have right now is not a functioning government.
Right.
What we have right now is insanity. Mm-hmm. and a family grift using the Ukraine as its storefront. You know, and you just have to wonder, Zelensky, can you not see this?
I know.
Putin does. Schultz does.
And also,
Elizabeth Truss does.
They'll dispose of Zelensky as soon as they.
Oh, I know. But anyway, there's something to be said about the continuity of government thing, because right now it looks like the public institutions are all going wacko nuts.
Yeah.
And now we have the FTX thing.
Yes. And I know that we're going to do a show just on that, because
that's
overwhelming.
Well, at least it's a bipartisan effort, Dan. Good old Mitch took some of that money.
But they're in the hot zone again, in the Bahamas.
I know.
Jeez.
Yeah. It's like, guys, can you get a new playbook?
Yeah.
You know, how many shares of Permandex stock did FTX actually hold? You know, we don't know.
Excellent point. Actually, I'm feeling the.
Look, Daniel, there's with the money laundering that we're seeing going to the political parties that we're seeing and using the entire Ukraine as the cutout in the process.
Wow.
I mean, tell me that this is not an outfit tailor-made to bankroll another Assassination Incorporated.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You made the excellent point about Permandex. It's still a very mysterious corporation. Yeah. I follow up on the Lewis Mortimer Bloomfield case, where all of the papers are still being held by that Canadian court, even though they're supposed to be released 20 years ago. And they have all his correspondence with Bush and everything else. But Bloomfield, of course, who headed up Permandex, and it's still shadowy in terms of what was going on there. But you made an excellent point about it. You said the name itself may give us a hint. Yeah. That it's a permanent index of people to be assassinated.
Yeah. That's exactly what I think the name was.
Incredible. Exactly.
And, you know, as for the role of the Bush family sitting and squatting right in the middle of it, again, I'm not surprised.
Wow.
You know, the Clintons are kind of the storefront.
Yes. They can handle Haiti.
They can take care of the odd teenage boy running across a cocaine drop, you know, in the middle of Arkansas. That, let them handle that.
Yeah.
But the big stuff, no. No.
No, that's pure Bush.
That's pure Bush.
And it's got generations.
It's just think of Prescott. What a wonderful man.
He was busted for trading with the enemy, but then they couldn't do anything about it, right?
It was not only that. He shows up after McCarthy's censure at Bethesda Hospital when McCarthy's in the hospital recovering from another one of his drinking bouts. And a couple days later, after Prescott shows up, you know, to make friendly and make nice, he shows up, McCarthy shows up dead.
Wow.
Under incredibly questionable circumstances. And then they give him the big funeral in the Senate and goodbye.
That's amazing. I mean, he flamed out. He's only there for a few years.
McCarthy has his field day from 1950 to 1954 with the Army McCarthy hearings. Mm-hmm. So it's a four year, and that's it.
Then he's wiped off.
And then he's worked. Yep. Yeah. 4 years. That was a big flame out. You know, he took a lot of people out with him in his time. You know, Millard Tidings, and by the way, speaking of Millard Tidings, the new pyramid book. I want everybody to be aware. The new pyramid book is at It's attempting to be at the publisher.
Excellent.
Warning, a lot of the material has appeared in the other books. It's just copied and pasted, but it's rearranged. But there's a lot of new material in the book, which brings us to Millard Tidings.
This is you rebooting the whole.
I'm trying to clarify the argument that got in the original three books, a lot of people simply couldn't follow the argument because I was throwing so much information at them. So what I did is I've gotten rid of all the extraneous stuff. I've rearranged the old material, put some new material in, and hopefully made the argument much clearer, which brings us to Millard Tidings and Joseph McCarthy. Because you will find, if you are paying attention, you will find yet another Monmouth, Millard Tidings, Joseph McCarthy link, believe it or not, squatting in that book.
Fascinating.
I promised people that I was going to disclose it sometime, and I thought, well, this is the perfect context
book. the book is it going to be out by Christmas?
No, it'll probably be out next year.
Next year. Okay.
That's provided my publisher will pick the dang thing up.
Oh, they have to. Are you kidding? They should be so happy to get you back.
Well, no. He's agreed to do the book. I literally sent it to him, and he hasn't picked it up yet.
Oh, wow.
And I see what you're saying. That irritates the daylights out of me.
I can't believe it. Is it still our friend there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It could be Atlantis. But I've been in this business way too long. I know. Nothing surprises me anymore, Daniel.
I don't even think I can leave that part in this interview.
No,
so probably not.
just cut to us laughing.
Unbelievable. Oh my God. Yeah.
Oh yes.
Shall we say it'll be an adventure?
Oh yes, it will be.
Joseph, the impact of the assassination 59 years later, still no records from the CIA, the government, still holding back to the Warren Commission explanation, even though we got a different explanation from the House Assassination Committee.
Right.
Which on the government side said there was a probable conspiracy in 1979. Right. The memory of John Kennedy, the impact that he had, and trying to address this secret system, the secret technology in this piece. Where are we now?
Well, we're in the same boat, only much worse. Kennedy, for me, I mean, just my own personal emotional reaction to it. You know, I lived through it. I saw it happen. I saw Jack Ruby, you know, shooting Oswald on TV live. So I remember it. And what I remember most about it was that was the end of America's innocence.
Right.
We are not a shining city on a hill. What we have done since that time is we have tried to become the world policeman on the basis of some sort of presumed moral superiority to everybody else. When the reality is, and we're seeing it in the last two elections, when the reality is we're a banana republic with nukes run by people who regard themselves as above the law. And as a consequence of that, and as a consequence of people not doing anything to stop them, it's going to get worse and worse and worse until it collapses. You know, we had a couple of shots where we might have been able to roll back the corruption, but at this point, I don't see it happening. The same people are in power. They're still running for the same playbook. It's obvious they're still running the same playbook, and they're not able to keep the game of three-card Monte going. It's coming to an end. One way or another, it's coming to an end. I mean, just look at the countries abandoning the dollar right now.
Right. Yeah, that's the clearest sign right there.
Yeah. And it's not because those countries are good or decent or moral, but they are at least not hypocritical.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, you know, this is the world we're moving into. And it's because there wasn't an outcry against the Warren report when it came out. There was an outcry in the sense that people knew it was hogwash, but they tried to pretend to go on with life as normal. Well, life wasn't normal after you murder a president in full daylight and then concoct a silly story to explain it.
Right.
It was the acceptance of the silly story more than the murder itself that was the end of innocence. It was the knowing acceptance of a hypocrisy, of a lie, that was the end of innocence.
Exactly. Wow. And here's the arc. 59 years later, Kennedy attempted to break through and rein that power back under executive control, put the CIA back in its place, smash the CIA. And instead, these days, they're trying to run a UFO threat, and they're thriving as ever.
And remember what else he tried to do. He tried to end the power of the Federal Reserve.
Yes.
And look where we are. You know, we're using monopoly money.
Wow.
And sooner or later, you know, I just read something very frightening. In the last couple of days, people have been sending me this article about how a study was done in France at one of their écoles politiques, you know, one of their political, let's train the elite here at this school.
Right.
And the study concluded that America is France's biggest enemy, biggest potential enemy, politically, militarily, and economically. America, not Russia, not communist China, not even the traditional enemy across the Rhine, not even the older traditional enemy across the English Channel. America.
Amazing.
France.
It's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. That's how bad the behavior of this government has gotten, and that's how bad it is being perceived.
Absolutely phenomenal. Yeah, well, that represents a real low moment if we're to our allies.
Yeah. Yeah, France, of all the allies that we want to be a threat to.
You're right.
Dumb.
Well, we remember the CIA trying to take De Gaulle out just before.
Yes, we do.
Yeah,
so exactly.
That force, operational. Joseph, just incredible, amazing today. Thank you so much on this.
Thanks for having me back.
And, of course, at Giza Death Star is where the work is. The new book is coming out early next year.
Cross your fingers.
Fingers crossed. And I want to highly recommend, of course, if people want to know about these things, Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, and LBJ and the Murder of President Kennedy. An incredible story, and told so well by you. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, and happy Thanksgiving and Merry Christmas to you and yours, and we'll probably see each other in the new year.
Definitely will. We'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks, Daniel. Bye-bye.
Joseph, just remarkable. And of course, you can find more Joseph Farrell's research and work and his books at GizaDeathStar.com. Amazing work, and a new book on the Great Pyramid in the works for early next year. Now, we will see you all on Fridays at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, live with the X Series. Some incredible shows coming up. Next week, former Assistant HUD Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz returns to the program. Just incredible. A lot to talk about there. And also some great, and I mean great, shows coming up for you in December. See you soon. All right, everyone, it's great to have you with us after that incredible Dr. Farrell episode. Now let's switch gears here and speak with former Assistant HUD Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz in part two of our deep interview. This conversation includes some powerful anecdotes from Catherine's past, as well as deep insights into where we stand going into 2023. It's great to have so many of you here with us on the Dark Journalist Show. Now, take it away, former Assistant HUD Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz. Well, this is an interesting thing, because if I have total control over weather warfare, which we know that they do, and they even admitted it, William Cohen, the defense secretary under Clinton, admitted that they had the technology. The question is, I can fake climate change. I can fake all kinds of forest fires and everything
Absolutely.
Else. Yeah.
One of my favorite, I have to tell you, one of my favorite posts on Solari.
Yeah.
Let me see if I can find it. It starts with a quote from Taylor Swift.
She's in the news a lot lately.
Oh, God. Can you imagine being Ticketmaster? Oof. Talk about a bad day. It's like when I was running the service bar and the whipped cream machine exploded and poured whipped cream all over a sable coat of a woman standing at the bar. Yeah, that was a bad night. But you know, it prepares you for working on Wall Street to deal with those kinds of situations. Okay. So it's called An Intelligent Conversation About the Environment. If you just go to Solari and put it in the search box.
Yes.
And it's a quote from Taylor Swift is, if you're yelling, you're the one who's lost control of the conversation.
Wow.
Okay. So what this was I have a wonderful ally who I adore, who was trying to bully me into promoting climate change on the Solari report.
Wow.
And I said, I'm not going to do it. And I'm not going to do it until I understand, you know, because what you're saying about climate change doesn't fit with my personal experience with reality.
Right.
And so I tell you what, I said, I will make you a list of the unanswered questions that I need to understand the answers to before I can have an intelligent conversation about climate change. But I'm going to send it to you now. And and if you can just answer these questions, I'm happy to then engage with a discussion of climate change on the website. And so here are my questions. He couldn't answer the questions.
Wow.
And, you know, one of them got into, can weather warfare be used to, you know, to promote climate change? So anyway, so but this has all the questions. And of course, he couldn't answer the questions. And I said, well, you know, if you can't answer the questions about the things that are impacting the environment, then you have no business proposing solutions as how to protect the environment. Because I'll tell you, in my lifetime, the number one destroyer of the environment is a fiat currency run by governance that's trying to harvest the whole planet. So, you know, if you look at what Mr. Global has done to centralized control, whether it's secrecy or the application of the central banking warfare model and the way it's been applied with fiat currency, all those things have done far more environmental damage than any, you name it, with maybe the possible exception of weather warfare. I don't know. I don't know enough about it. But, you know, so I just, if you're not willing to grapple with changing the financial model in a healthy way, then I don't want to hear about your climate change because I can't take you seriously. You're not dealing with the root causes.
Right.
I'm just not, you know, it's.
You're just going to look good for nonprofit activity and you're going to be virtue signaling to a degree where you're not really seeing what's going on the ground.
Well, but I think a lot of those people are sincere, whether they've been misled or whether they've been mind controlled. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, we've all been misled or mind controlled or both sometime in our life. So,
but you know, if you say that, but if you say that, you're a conspiracy theorist, you're a Q person, you're, you know, whatever.
Right. Yeah, but I don't take people.
And I know that you're
seriously, not. I'm a conspiracy generator. So I'm totally into conspiracies. I grew up being trained by the people who ran the country to believe in conspiracies, to practice conspiracies. I love conspiracies. Conspiracies are how you invent your future. I'm totally into conspiracies. So this idea that conspiracies are not cool, you know, tells me that you have no power to create your future because you don't know how to do it and you don't want to engage in the things that make it happen.
Absolutely.
So I'm a conspiracy generator, you know, and I used to be a conspiracy foot shoulder. I mean, that's what I was trained to do is implement conspiracies, right? So I don't, you know.
Well, we know the CIA.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
The CIA created the term to block them from any culpability in the presidential assassination. They created it in 1967. This is a long history of using the term for derogatory purposes.
Right. But I think the major derogatory purpose is the only way you can implement a successful conspiracy is if you can design one. So you have to be able to generate conspiracy theories if you're going to come up with a good design of conspiracy, let alone implement it. So I think they wanted to make people powerless by getting them to back off of the core talents you need to invent your future.
Right. They wanted to hold it exclusively for themselves.
Well, but it's a way of thinking. I mean, I've told you this before. I'll never forget when I started Hamilton Securities Group. We were hired to be the lead financial advisor to basically design $12 billion of auctions of distressed mortgages. And traditionally, when you auction distressed mortgages, non-performing mortgages, you would make a guess 6 weeks before the auction. Should I market into the securities market? Should I market into the real estate market? Or should I market into the mortgage market? And what I said is, you know, something I'm not smart enough to know 6 months from now or 6 weeks from now, which is going to be, you know, the most aggressive market in terms of price. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go get optimization technology, which the, you know, the national labs have, AT&T Bell Labs has. They used it for, you know, routing the telephone calls. They use it for, you know, scheduling airlines. I'm going to go get them and I'm going to create a bid process where all three markets can bid, self-stratify, and then we simply calculate what is the most optimal combination from all three markets. And that's how we choose the winner, because it generates more money. We're gonna compete the three markets against each other and directly, which was unheard of that they would compete directly against each other in this kind of situation. Mm-hmm. We're going to put together due diligence packages so some guy in Singapore can lob in a bid for $50 because he doesn't have to do the due diligence. We will have one of the top accounting firms in the world do the due diligence for him and make all the databases so they can just lob it in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to completely computerize the whole thing. And so we're going to compete the three markets and we're going to compete them internationally against each other.
Right.
Because markets work. And that was exactly, I put it, we hired AT&T Bell Laboratories and we got them to take the model they use for routing telephone calls, airline scheduling, to do the model. And we launched it and we announced it. And that was the day I called the guy who ran the real estate portfolio at the Harvard Endowment. And he picked up the phone and he screamed at the top of his lungs. And this was a very sort of mild-mannered guy.
Wow.
At the top of his lungs. And I said, Michael, hi, how are you? I couldn't believe it. I was shocked. I would have told you that guy would never do such a thing.
Incredible.
And he was so angry. He was furious. And I said, what's the problem? And he said, I hate this optimization model. I said, why? I think it's brilliant. You know, this is a brilliant application from another industry into the financial markets that will completely, you know, get huge increased performance on the bids. And he said, the only way I can win is bid higher. I said, exactly, Mike, that's the idea. Well, but it's interesting because, you know, I had 2 years before, approximately 2 years before, made a deal with him to play a dedicated investment bank for one of his companies. And then he showed up at the signing ceremony and pulled a switch hit on me. Oh. At which point I walked. I said, you know, I don't do business with people who switch hit me at the closing table. Mm-hmm. You know, that's zero integrity. You don't do that. And there were other things he wanted that just would have made the business not successful. So when you put conditions on me that are going to ensure my downfall, why would I do that? Anyway, so I walked and had to sell my house to finance the business because the deal broke through. So the only reason I was representing HUD to design the optimization model was because he reneged on his deal. Otherwise, I would have been representing him and he would have made a fortune and HUD would have continued to, you know,
what fail a strange for the taxpayers. Fate there. Whatever happened to this guy?
Well, it's interesting. So when they came after us, interestingly enough, we had a contract essentially $1 million a month was what we were paid to do all the financial advisory work. And right when they came after us, he spun out of the internal Harvard thing, started a company, and they had a contract for about the same amount every month. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So I could speculate on what I think his role was. But I would say he would probably say if he was doing the show that he got me back. But what I would say is, you know, getting spun out of the establishment was probably the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. So I want to thank him. So I want to personally thank Mike and the Harvard Endowment for making sure I had absolutely no future in the establishment. And from the bottom of my heart, thank you.
I'm going to take the video over to them. It's.
I'm sure they watch these things. Anyway, so you know, I guess
you have a lot of people to thank. You can thank Jack Kemp also.
Yeah, I can thank Jack Kemp. I do, because you know something. Yeah. You know, I didn't belong there, and yeah. I'll never forget in 1998 when the Department of Justice offered me a settlement. That was wholly unacceptable. I mean, it basically would say, you know, you can steal my stuff whenever you want and I have to go along with it. And I sat down and I spent a week trying to decide if I would fight. I told you this story. Mm-hmm. You know, and usually I don't spend a week making a decision. That's about the longest I've ever spent making a decision. And I really went through it systematically. And I said, you know, because you're not supposed to be able to survive in the wilderness. Right. And I didn't know if I could. But I thought, you know, I have the training and I have the resources. Because I was willing to go down to peanut butter and jelly, and I did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have the training and I have the resources to do this. And I probably have the wherewithal to reinvent myself. Because I knew I had to reinvent myself working for individuals, and I knew that was very difficult for someone who came from a sort of wholesale background to fathom retail. Anyway,
oh, yeah.
I knew I could do it, but I knew how hard it would be. I thought I did. It turned out to be harder. But I didn't know when it was over if I would have the capacity to love. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't have the capacity to love when it was over, what was the point?
Yeah.
So, but I knew I wouldn't have the capacity to love if I went along. So that was the trick. The trick was, okay, can I fight this in a way when it's over? I have the capacity to love. I still have my empathy. And so to say that the way I went about it was unusual, I had to go about solving my litigation in a way that solved the bigger problem. You know, mm-hmm. what was really going on this planet? What could we all do about it? So it had to be part of a bigger solution than just my litigation. It had to be, I had to get a map of the whole shebang.
Interesting. It went from that individual microcosm situation to the big macro of what's happening.
Well, always, because the reason I was doing what I was doing was I thought I had to deal with the top guys to go figure out how we could turn things around really in a way that would build tremendous wealth. So mm-hmm. I thought I was looking for real solutions for them. And I'm sure the guy who promised me that it was fine and yes, go do it, probably even forgot he had the conversation with me. Because it turns out he was one of the guys who threw me overboard. So I guess he didn't remember.
Well, they threw you overboard, and but some telltale pieces were with you. Like when the guy talked to you and said in the 90s, oh, they've already given up on the country. They're shipping all the money out.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I have to tell you, I got fabulous training. Mm-hmm. I just had the world's best training, especially when it came to finance and money. And I worked with a whole bunch of people in the financial world, both before Wall Street and on Wall Street. You know, something, they were really great. And they taught me a lot. And then when I got to Wall Street, they gave me a chance to, you know, I got a couple of huge projects that people thought couldn't get done, and I was given free rein to do them. It was fabulous. And that's, you know, that was always what if I have a gift, it's as an investment banker. Mm-hmm. I have an incredible gift and I love it. I just can't tell you how much I love it. And that was the great tragedy, was when I got booted out, it meant I couldn't. You know, I couldn't be an investment banker, because you can't be an investment banker without huge resources. You know, yeah. You're talking about swinging around billions of dollars, and I lost the ability to do that. And that was my great passion, my great love. So that was the hard part for me. It was walking away from, it's like being an artist, and you walk away and you walk into a world where you'll never be allowed to have pain again.
Wow. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
But you created this independent structure, and it's opening up so many doors.
I tried to create an independent structure, but meantime, people kept asking me questions. And I kept answering the questions, and those questions grew into two businesses that where I'm still answering questions. So much for my concept of, you know, structure and what I was going to do. It was just, you have to follow the market. What is it that you do? You know, I always tell people when they get booted out of the corporation establishment, I said, look, anytime somebody asks you to help them, just do it and just keep doing it and see where it leads. And don't think of it as one thing. You know, if there are five areas where people are asking you for help, just help them and see where it leads. Be useful.
That is quite the philosophy. Yeah.
Right.
Nicholas Brady is in that whole web of your associations in that period.
Well, Nick was the chairman of Dillon Reed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I worked with him or for him when he was at Dillon Reed. Then he went into Treasury, and I had a few minor dealings with him when he was in the administration. When I started Hamilton, I went over to visit him, but he wasn't very interested in what I was up to. Uh-huh. So, and I've only had one contact with him since the litigation happened.
Amazing.
And that was a pretty funny story. So he what had many. Contact? What?
What was the contact?
Well, it was kind of an unusual thing. I'm in my office and I've got client meetings all day long that day and the next day. And one of the people who runs our customer service calls me and she said, Nick Brady wants to talk to you and it's an emergency. It's urgent. And he needs you right away. And I have a rule, which is you don't cancel a meeting with a paying customer for billionaires who don't pay you. Okay. You know, you need to understand who your paying customers are. Uh-huh. And I got in a bit of squabble because she got really pushy. And I said, I don't care how important Nick Brady is. You know, I have meetings and I'm happy to schedule. So my first time free was the next morning. If I started early, I could take a call. So I said, call him back and tell him I'm happy to talk with him at 8 a.m. Well, anyway, I won't bore you with the detail because there's a back and forth with the woman who runs customer service, who was convinced we would all die if we didn't, you know, if I didn't take Nick Brady's phone call. And then she told him and he said he if he needed me still, he would call. And then he never called.
Interesting.
And I asked a spooky person once, what was that about? And she said, just the fact that he was willing to call me and I was willing to talk to him scared whoever he was negotiating with enough that he got what he wanted and then he didn't need to talk to me. Yeah. I don't know.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. It sounds just like the kind of move. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm always willing to receive information. So mm-hmm. I have no idea what it was about. But he never called back. So
interesting. Catherine, amazing.
I missed my chance, but you know something? It was a great client. I stayed on the phone with
him. I think you did the right thing. I think you did
thing. No, it's really funny. I used to, when I first started as an investment advisor, I would get these calls. We have $100 billion that we want to invest to change the world, and we want you to represent us. And I would say, okay, well, that's fine, but I work on retainer. So the upfront retainer payment is X and it's this much every 6 months in advance. So you have to do the fee and you have to do the retainer. It's upfront. And they would say, oh, well, that's tiny dollars. We can't deal with this. We have billions. And I said, well, you have billions, but I don't. So you have to pay upfront or else I'm not doing, well, we just want you to do, you know, and so they would suck people into, I don't know, 1500 hours of work. And I would refuse to do it. I was like, I'm not working for 5 minutes until you pay the retainer. Yeah. And if you have hundreds of billions, I'm sure you can pay my tiny little retainer. And they wouldn't.
And that's the commitment.
Well, but I can't tell you how many people I've seen lose not only thousands of hours that way, but lose their reputation, lose trust among millions of people because they're promising, oh, they have hundreds of billions and we're going to. I remember there was this one group who went along for God knows how many hours. And they said to me, basically, you know, your problem is you're just not used to playing in our leagues and you think small. And, you know, the idea was I was, you know, basically a member of the lower classes and couldn't understand what it was like to play in these, you know, these heady environments. And I was just thinking they got you guys by the short hairs. It turned out I was right. I was totally right.
Amazing. Catherine, three quick questions before you have to go. I know you have to leave, but one, I wanted to mention this to you. Marco Rubio and Kirsten Gillibrand, Senator from New York and Senator from Florida, have attached the new UFO office in the government to the National Defense Authorization Act.
Uh-oh.
For the first time.
And they made a big point that nothing would go through for 2023 in terms of military funding without that office being a part and being passed as part of NDAA.
What does that represent?
I don't know. I just think, you know, there's more trouble than you can shake a stick at coming out of the defense authorization. So, you know, I don't know, but I just don't see a good thing coming out of that.
Interesting.
But every time the defense, I mean, the defense authorization always comes with a sock in the jaw.
Absolutely. In a nutshell, SPACs, and why did you cover it and make the whole new episode about it?
Because it proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that the pandemic was an op.
I see.
It's, and if you look at the prices on SPACs and the prices on crypto, that we track Bitcoin and SPACs together, what it shows you is, you know, it's what I describe as a vaccine marketing plan. You get a huge generation of men busy trading and thinking they're masters of the universe, and you just completely sideline them from protecting their family and their real assets. It's tragic.
Absolutely fascinating. Everyone should get their hands on this report, and we'll let everyone know.
Yeah. Don't you love the graphics?
Yes.
I mean the people who do graphics, it's my Dutch partner. You know, he is a genius, but this one, I just, you know, this one was off the charts genius. So, because you're trying to communicate a really complicated, dense financial thing and prove a point and bring it down to, you know, the bottom line. And we had a great team that did the data collection, the data analysis, then the charts, the graphs. But then he brought it out with this laundromat theme. And, you know, trying to make a dense financial topic and bring it down to nuts and bolts and sort of a 411 for non-financial people, that's hard to do. And I think, you know, I think our team just did a great job. They did a great job.
Absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, they love making... They love taking the complexity of what you and I are dealing with and making it understandable for people. So I got to jump.
Fantastic. It's great to see you.
It's great to see Daniel. Be careful up there in Harvard land, okay?
All right, we'll talk soon. Have a great weekend. Bye. And that was Catherine Austin Fitz, the former HUD secretary, assistant HUD secretary, and just incredible things with her new report, SPACs, which gets us into all sorts of interesting money laundering and IPOs and all the rest of it. Highly recommended. And of course, her site is Solari.com. We'll see you all next week.